The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of ExchangeWire's MadTech Podcast. Delighted to be joined today, all the way from Singapore, by Joe McKenzie, MD of Publicist Media Precision in APAC. Hello, Joe.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Delighted to see someone in Singapore. We had our usual pre-recording, the world of COVID chat, so we don't need to cover any of that. Let's think about all the positive things we've got to look forward to in the world of marketing and advertising. And to add to that, the level of positivity, delighted to be sharing the podcast today for the first time in ages with Kieran O'Kane, ExchangeWire CEO. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, Rachel. Great to be back in the podcast that I started. I've been kicked off with the last couple of episodes. So it's nice to be invited back to my podcast.
One of Kieran's favourite things is he comes up with an idea, we perfect it, and then he gets cross with us. So that's where that's coming from, Joe. Getting started with the first news story of the week that I wanted to discuss with the two of you. The Advertising Standards Authority, which is it's a UK self-regulatory body for the advertising industry, is launching an investigation into claims made by large companies and brands regarding environmental sustainability and green credentials. So part of the investigation is going to focus on the extent to which these companies make claims that they can achieve certain environmental sustainability standards and how they represent that specifically in their advertising. So they're going to be looking at commonly used terms such as carbon neutral, net zero, and hybrid, and they'll be focusing in the first instance on the energy and transport sectors, but it's expected they're going to fan out to include other sectors as well. So they're seeking out misleading claims and socially irresponsible advertising to, in the first instance, presumably protect consumers' rights, but also because they're making an attempt to clarify the general public's understanding of some of these environmental sustainability terms, because they do seem to get thrown about quite a lot these days with abandon. So the outcome of these investigations is going to be really interesting. The CMA, the Competition Markets Authority in the UK, are also promising a similar inquiry at some stage during 2020. So I'm really interested in this story because from my point of view, it comes at a really interesting time, because there's been a lot of focus on misleading claims and socially irresponsible messaging associated with the pandemic. So I'm wondering if this is representing almost a little bit of a groundswell behind the notion of tackling misinformation. And then also environmental sustainability and the climate crisis is, of course, immensely important at the moment. And there is quite a focus on not just what businesses, organisations, companies and advertisers are doing around environmental sustainability, but I also think there's arguably a need for a bit of a focus on how advertising can play a role in tackling environmental sustainability and, positioning themselves from a socially responsible point of view. So I'm really interested to hear what both of you think. But let's start with you, Joe. We're working for a large advertising agency. I'm sure this is kind of regular conversation for you guys.
Yeah, look, I think you're right. It's a really interesting time. We've got the COP26 that's happening up in Glasgow at the moment as well, and all of these issues being sort of highlighted to the extreme. It also comes off the back of Mark Kaufman article that he wrote in Mashable a few weeks ago, which sort of highlighted the carbon footprint sham, as he called it, which was basically the coining of the phrase carbon footprint and the carbon footprint calculator, which was designed by a well-known advertising agency for a well-known petroleum company. And I think it just highlights how important these issues have become for a lot of people. And I think with, as you say, the kind of situation that we find ourselves in now, the extreme events of the last 2 years with all of these extreme climate events, we've got the pandemic. I think all of this is coming to the fore, and these issues are being amplified and reinforced as a result. Climate is hugely important, and there's a responsibility not just on governments to address it. And I think we all collectively feel an individual responsibility to try and address it. But now, the focus is really on what are the brands doing equally to address it, and how are they holding, being held to account? So, you know, there are two sides to that coin. You can start to amplify and praise your efforts from a corporate social responsibility standpoint, or you can come unstuck by overclaiming. And I think it's great what the ASA are doing. And I think, you know, I'd like to see more initiatives like that happening across the world that will really kind of tackle these issues head on. It's increasingly an important issue for a lot of people. I think historically it's been one of sort of a demographic difference in demographic opinion, as it were. So if you talk to my father's generation, he's probably less interested, but certainly what's coming through is that the younger generations are finding this a very key issue. And the Deloitte Millennial and Gen Z survey that came out a couple of months ago actually cites climate and protecting the environment as the most important issue for the Gen Z generation. And I think, you know, brands do need to hold themselves accountable to their impact on the environment, and they need to hold themselves accountable to the things that they claim about that as well. So fantastic initiative.
Yeah, really interesting. And like you said, it will be really interesting to see if other initiatives across other global markets could be launched off the back of this. I'd have thought that there'd be a lot of associations in the APAC region that would be interested in trying to do something similar. So it'd be great to see something similar pop up there as well, right? And yeah. I guess not surprising at all that, you know, that those results in the millennials survey, because young people can see a future where they have to live with the consequences of what we're currently doing to the environment, right? So enormously important to them. And you can only imagine that therefore that will become integrated into the way that they make buying decisions as they get older and have more purchasing power. So, you know, brands who either ignore this altogether, you just can't imagine anyone's doing that, but I'm sure there are brands that are doing it. And like you said, brands that overstate what they're doing do so at their peril, really, I'd have thought.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it's interesting to think about what the differences in regional opinion around some of these issues. And I think, you know, one of the things that surprised me was how much, you know, we used to do from a recycling and individual effort perspective back in the UK versus how little was being done in sort of a lot of this region, especially Southeast Asia. But I think these issues are certainly coming to the fore, and it's the younger generation that are that are raising them. There's a little initiative that started in Bali called Bye Bye Plastic Bags. And it was two teenagers out of Bali, Isabel and Malati Wisdom. I'm going to pronounce their surname incorrectly, but they literally were getting concerned with the amount of plastic that was washing up in the beaches and being caused by all the tourism. So they made it an issue and rallied support. And in 2018, they got plastic banned completely from that island. So in Bali, you won't see a plastic bag or plastic straws. And, you know, now they are sort of activists on the global scene. And it's their voices that are impacting the most amount of change and really sort of steering the politicians on the policy and regulation they've got to make. And I think in the same way, you know, the brands and the advertisers that we work with on a regular basis need to be taking that quite seriously, because everyone cares about this, but particularly the future generation of customers.
Yeah. Kieran.
I would say there's a term going around a minute called greenwashing, which brands are trying to engage in quite a lot. How the hell could Ryanair have a carbon neutral footprint? That's impossible unless they own half the Amazon forest and they're offsetting it. I do think that this is interesting because a lot of brands are reactive rather than proactive in this space. That, as to Joe's point, that they see a lot of, you know, very aware people around the state of the planet. Like, let's be honest, global warming or global chaos warming or whatever you want to call it is real. Weather patterns are changing. It will have an effect on, you know, countries at a low sea level, like Bangladesh and others, and there'll be forced migrations globally as this thing gets worse. And during the middle of this century, we could be in an absolute shitstorm in terms of like geopolitical mess. So the brands, I guess, they're going, well, we need to sell more stuff. We need people to kind of buy into what we're doing. But there is an element of like, you know, greenwashing here. And I think that again, this comes down to our like conversation previously before we got on air here, was about taking personal responsibility. I almost feel consumers are abdicating their own personal responsibility, going, oh, you know, you see a Carlsberg ad and Carlsberg have stopped using plastic and there's a little turtle and he's also happy. And you go, all right, I'll have a pint of Carlsberg and I'll feel good about myself because there's one less turtle not dead in the world after this point. 6 points in, six turtles have survived and you're absolutely drunk. But you see what I'm saying? It's a kind of like, you're not really taking responsibility. And you can blame the brands up to a point. And the ASA is great that they're coming in and sort of, you know, really putting up, you know, basically telling brands you can't lie or you can't sort of like massage the numbers to suit a specific narrative. But I do think, like, if we're going to extend this out, I do think that more people need to be worried about this problem. All the people who kind of go, oh, yeah, well, I'll be dead in 20 years. I don't really care. Well, you do have grandchildren or you do have relatives and, you know, you have responsibility to kind of leave this place in a good state. Like, so I think, like, we could go into this for hours, but I think brands probably need to be a bit more proactive rather than reactive. That's the thing that I get out of this. You know, if Ryanair wants to push this, they should really buy a bunch of land in Eastern Europe or whatever and plant trees and actually take a proactive step instead of like the, and I know there's like offsetting carbon footprint, et cetera, in the European market, which is great. But that isn't live yet. So this is all kind of like, you know, veering on the lion territory a little bit, you know, mistruths and all the rest of it. So I'm glad the ASA is taking a strong approach to this. But I think the lesson here is that brands need to kind of really be more proactive. It's all well and good, you know, two young girls in Bali or two young people in Bali making that move. Brands have to have some kind of, you know, responsibility for the planet as well. If they're building products, they're drawing resources, they should think about their supply chains, the pollution, the causes, all the rest of it. They should really have that. And I suppose that is kind of been baked into the likes of ESG and all the rest of it, public stocks where, you know, like big pension funds now won't invest in fossil fuels, etc. So I guess there is something going on, but I would like brands to be a bit more proactive and rather than reactive because a few millennials don't like what they're doing.
I think, I mean, I think one thing that's come out of the carbon footprint debate is that before we heard about carbon footprints and carbon calculators and stuff like that, no one was even thinking about it. But the question which was raised in this essay is, you know, was the oil company passing responsibility onto the customer? Because it's saying you and your actions will determine the fate of the planet. And, you know, your individual reduction on energy usage or driving your car less will reduce the amount of emissions on the planet. At the same time, their business model is to encourage you to buy more fuel. So, you know, you can't use one agenda to service your own, you know, to pass on the buck. And I think, you know, there is a lot of misinformation that's going on out there. I can tell you right now, in my kitchen cupboard, I have a packet of cling film that is branded something and it's got degradable on it. So it doesn't have biodegradable, but the packaging is all earthy brown wrap and it's got leaves on it.
Degradable over 1,000 years.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly.
It's like nuclear waste.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, definitely the brands need to be accountable to their impact on the planet, and their customers collectively can have an impetus on that. But I think it's great that the ASA are taking action to police it. At least there is an independent body that's taken a view on whether these claims are legitimate or not, and therefore whether this company is credible for their green credentials or not.
There's one point I want to introduce that. I think that if a brand decided to go all in on the green thing, right, and actually being more proactive, it has a huge effect on them, right? We look at Tesla, right? And Elon Musk, right? The electric car, you could say that it wasn't people that pushed the likes of Ford and all the car companies to invest heavily in electric vehicles. It was actually Elon Musk, right? And Elon Musk has benefited from being pure 100% electric because the future of cars and autos is electric, right? But the share price has gone mental. Could you imagine if some of the brands you work with, Joe, decided, oh, we're all in on the green thing. We're going to be a green company. We have aspirations to be like totally eco-friendly. We're going to innovate what we do in terms of supply chain, products use. That would have a massive effect financially for them, our stock price, because people will buy into that. They'll see that this company has future-proofed itself for the new eco-friendly age. And Zillennials buy into that, and the future generation, because like once all these old codgers, these coffin dodgers die, it's the kids that are going to be left to buy the products.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I was working for Renault. They were my client back in Dublin in 2010. And I remember them making the announcement that they were going to shift to a fully electric vehicle strategy over 15 years, I think it was. I think it was by 2025 was their plan. I can't remember having a massive impact on their share price because I think with that comes a high degree of nervousness.
10 years, like, I mean when did you work there? 25 years? That's ridiculous. Tesla built the first car in a three-year period. Like, they could have easily moved across. It would have hurt them in the short term. Long term, it could have been a huge game changer for them.
No, totally. But I think, you know, these are businesses with infrastructures and expertise and resources and business models that are completely dependent on an old system. And so their logic was, you know, we'll give ourselves time and we'll adjust. And I think they were the first major sort of car manufacturer to make that announcement. And obviously, everyone else is now sort of following suit. But, you know, those timescales don't exist anymore. We know that the planet is, you know, crumbling faster than we could ever have imagined now. And that everything that we do from this point forward is dependent on, you know, defines what future we're going to enjoy. So I think no one has the luxury of time to make these statements anymore. And if they are going to make them, they need to follow up very, very quickly with action.
I'm buying a Tesla.
You're buying a Tesla. Well, maybe just not. Exactly. I was going to say there's so many issues just even associated with that comment. Like, you live in London, you don't need a car. A, B. There's plenty of other things that you could do with your hard-earned cash rather than buy a Tesla that might be a bigger contribution.
It's tax deductible.
So the UK government to encourage people to buy electric cars. But, you know, we'll have to draw this one to a close. There's just so much more that we could talk about. But just one thing I wanted to say before we do is that, you know, this approach from the ASA, the thing that I like about it is it reminds me of days when I used to work in the public sector. And one of the jobs that I had was dealing with our environment department that used to do everything from waste collection and recycling collection to sorting out the streetscape, the local streetscape. And one of the major challenges that they had in the early days of refining the doorstep recycling service here in London, and I'm sure this was UK-wide, was trying to educate people about what could be included in the recycling and what couldn't be. One of the biggest issues was the little recycling symbol that appeared on packaging, which it turns out doesn't actually mean that a piece of packaging is recyclable, right? So just tackling those basic things like messaging, you know, symbols, which is all associated with advertising, potentially could make a huge difference, right? So it's good that the ASA has taken this approach. Anyway, let's move on. Second news story. Netflix have launched a free mobile-only plan in Kenya in a bid somewhat to increase sign-up of new customers and obviously in the hope to convert those customers to paying subscribers. So subscription numbers for Netflix have slowed over the last couple of months, but, I mean, that's probably not unexpected. You know, it's been a massive period of a change in consumer behaviour over the last 18 months, and they got an enormous boost from lots of stay-at-home orders during the pandemic. Those have been loosened up in many regions, so it was probably likely to follow that subscriber numbers might dip. But we know that their strategy has been for a long time looking towards expanding markets or developing economies to boost their subscriber numbers and to try to build a bigger share of business in those markets where they see less competition. And a lot of African countries would fall into that category. So this is an interesting move in Kenya. The offering will be advertising free and very similar to the type of experience that subscribers have on Netflix. It's just that the content will be limited. So my big question to the two of you, will this work? Is this going to get Netflix a bigger market share in Kenya? Is it going to help them convert some of these free subscribers to paid subscribers? Or is this a segue to the long anticipated potential advertising revenue model that Netflix might have no choice but to adopt? Discuss. We've been throwing that one in the mix for about 4 years at Exchange One, and people have routinely said, no way, Netflix is never going to carry advertising.
So Kieran, I'm getting into my Tesla to drive to Kenya and I'll, you know, avail of this free service that they're having. It'll offset the cost of the Tesla. I think it's an interesting idea. It's typically American that, you know, that an African or even, you know, low salary, low income economies are going to be able to afford a Netflix subscription every month. I think I do think this is going to be, they're going to test and learn here, and then eventually they're going to realize that we need to run ads on the free service in these economies, because it just doesn't work. It doesn't add up. Reed Hastings would be spitting blood if he heard this podcast. I'm sure he's a big listener, so big shout out to Reed. How you doing? It's a neat idea, but like, I just don't, the economics just add up to me. Scalability. Netflix, will it hit? Well, the thing about Netflix, will it hit a wall eventually in terms of user growth? And like, there's only so many things that people can subscribe to. There's only so many subscribers in the world. It just doesn't add up.
You're going Netflix for ad funded.
I still believe that there will be some kind of ad-funded model in there. It could be literally billions of dollars. Eventually, shareholders are going to start asking questions. Once subscriptions start hitting the skids, you'll start saying, like, investors go, look, we want to see revenue. We want to see profit, right? And it's like, okay, how do we do that? How do we keep growing subscriber base? How do we keep, we're burning through loads of cash. Netflix have some amazing content. I don't know if you've seen, that new Korean thing called Squid. Have you seen it yet? Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it yet.
It's absolutely amazing. He gets kidnapped. They're all in debt, and they get kidnapped by some mysterious guy put on an island. They're all playing these random games, and they're dying. It's a bit like Hunger Games meets Old Boy, if you've seen Old Boy from the Korean films. It's amazing. But like, this is the type of stuff they're doing, but at some stage, you know, they'll have to justify that to investors. Like, I mean, is Netflix now, you know, it was a growth stock. What is it now? Like, it needs to show like real revenue, real returns, real profit. And I think eventually they're going to have to start looking at, you know, marketing, whether it's product placement, which I believe is one of their big plays, or ads in low cost economies to kind of offset the cost of production. Maybe low ad loads, to minimize the ad loads, so it's not like a horrible experience. But yeah, I think that eventually it's weird. You see companies who kind of like poo-poo ads and then suddenly embrace them as a real model, like Facebook.
Well, perhaps not suddenly, yeah, and perhaps not suddenly in this case. It's taken a long time. But anyway, Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I think kudos to Netflix for trying to protect their ad-free model. That's clearly what they're trying to do. And I think the big thing with this offer is that they're making 25% of their catalogue or their library available, which I think is unheard of. But will it convert people to paying for a subscription eventually? Because that's obviously the end goal. And I think Kieran's right. You know, I think the average salary in Kenya is $350 a month. I think the cheapest subscription globally is in Argentina at about $3.50 a month. It's a decent chunk of change if your total monthly income is $350. I think it will get them subscriptions. I think it will give them first mover advantage in a developing market. I think it will satisfy shareholders for a bit because the numbers will look good. It's obviously cracking into Africa, but they're already in all the African markets anyway. It represents a new phase, I think, for Netflix. I think it's going to be much, much harder for them going forward. There's a lot of competition on the scene now. who are all bringing different things into play. Most of it's been content driven, but will it convert people in Kenya to pay for a subscription? I think that's a bit of a long ask, that one.
I wonder if they could do a mixed model where they work with the telcos and they take a rev share and a new so Netflix could license it to telcos and make some money off the back of it. That's the only way I could see it happening, because obviously, you know, that's one way to kind of like get cash, because obviously you need a phone in these countries. You need a phone anywhere. You need to pay a monthly license fee or bill.
They have actually done that already. So they've partnered with local telco operators for some sort of popular regional shows. So there's one called Queen Sono and Diva, and they're also partnering with production companies in Nigeria. So yeah, there is a bit of that going on, right? And I guess that's where as well they'll get a lot of first mover advantage by securing those relationships and those partnerships early on in the piece. Then they're in a much better position to mix up the model, right?
Definitely. I mean, I know they've also been investing in the tech to make to package the data more efficiently, because in markets like Kenya, where the data, you know, mobile availability is patchy and data costs are high, it all adds to the barriers to entry, right? So, you know, if they make it free, they make it efficient, then it will get them the user base. It's just how do they then properly monetize that to balance the infrastructure and all the costs.
And ultimately, how do they balance all of this against their what has got to be growing and continually escalating production costs? They produce some knock it out the park content, which we all love consuming, but God, that's got to be expensive. How, you know, does it weigh up? Anyway, right, moving us on to the third news story, because we're running out of time. An interesting US-focused study on the state of digital tech adoption and digital transformation, stating that digital transformation for many companies still is coming at a very slow pace, or a fairly slow pace, due in part to a high number of tech solutions that any given organization's got in their tech stack. Also the integration and usability issues which flow on from this, trying to integrate new technology solutions in an existing stack, and dealing with staff trying to skill up and understand how to use those solutions. And as well as that, the increased complexity that's coming from the growth of innovation tech categories, which, you know, arguably are the very categories that are driving digital transformation, such as machine learning and AI. So there's further issues that the study highlighted as well, which is sort of a lack of staff skills and knowledge around how to use and apply some of these technology solutions. And also the study noted that digital adoption platforms, or DApps, we love a three-letter acronym in the advertising world, are becoming increasingly popular because they're platforms that make it easier for companies to adopt new technology platforms, and also to simplify the user experience, so tackle some of those challenges around staff skills and knowledge, not just on the training side, but also on how they actually physically adopt using those new platforms. So, I mean, I have to admit, when I read this, it just felt like a bit of a synopsis of the ad tech industry. So I feel like this is really familiar territory. And I'm fascinated to know what your experience might be, Joe. Again, you'll be no doubt working at the coalface of digital transformation with so many of your clients, and also within the agency group. And also, I'm just interested in the notion of digital adoption platforms, because are we coming to a point in digital transformation where the volume of technology solutions is so great that you actually need another technology platform to manage that volume of solutions, and then you need some other kind of solutions to handle that sort of integration and operability challenge? And laughing because Joe's got some visitors in the background, which actually this is totally like that BBC skit with the, or not skit, that BBC interview.
Something was going to happen, but Yeah, anyway.
I really enjoyed that. That was great. That was brilliant. Yeah, so basically over to you. What do you think of it? What's your experience of digital transformation? And I guess my last point there was, are we kind of reaching a volume of technology solutions that are trying to accelerate digital transformation, that actually the management of those solutions is becoming in and of itself a digital transformation issue? Joe?
Wow. So this is just a massive topic. I mean, we obviously we're dealing with digital transformation in the sense that we're helping our clients navigate some of the challenges that they're facing, particularly around the kind of communication side of their businesses. And at the same time, we're trying to manage our own digital transformation. And from a publicist standpoint, I think, you know, the last 18 months have been quite telling. So pandemic hit, we were all told to go and work from home. And I think within 2 or 3 days, we were enrolled in programs, you know, teaching us how to use Teams and run meetings virtually and do all of those things. And we were literally just thrown in at the deep end, go make it work. On top of that, you know, we've launched Marcel, which is essentially kind of a similar aid to digital transformation in the sense that it connects 80,000 people within our organization around ideation, research, knowledge. And, you know, it's really interesting to see since that was announced, gosh, when was that? 2018, I think, how that's evolving. And it's really starting to make sense in terms of, you know, our learning and developments in there, and we can research new business pitches across an entire global network, and we can get all sorts of information. So to that extent, you know, we're trying stuff out. But on the converse, yes, there are so many different things to think about. There are too many platforms that we're having to manage. And it is kind of laughable that every time new technology comes into play, we need to invent another technology that helps us manage it. And my example from an ad tech point of view is we used to have ad networks, then came ad exchanges. But to manage ad exchanges, we needed to bring in DSPs. And every few years, it's like it becomes more and more complicated. And yet there's more stuff that's coming over the top of it. So I actually had to look up what a digital adoption platform was when you sent me that article, if I'm honest. So that shows that we're not using it in Singapore yet. But it is really interesting. And I think vital in terms of helping companies navigate the adoption of technology across the board. And it's just a question of how would that roll out in our industry? It makes sense to me in, you know, if you're in HR, that there's a set of tools that you're going to be exposed to that you can get guided through an adoption platform technology. But for an organization like ours, where we've got multiple brands, multiple markets, multiple clients, different vertical sectors, it's not immediately obvious whether one solution would fit our organization and help us to implement the change in the same way. But there's no doubt about it. It's a big challenge for a lot of organizations. And there's this phrase, the overwhelmed worker, that now exists. So that's what these technologies are designed to fix.
And I found it just really interesting that they were measuring the pace of digital transformation and that actually it hasn't sped up. That's kind of fascinating, right? Because I feel like there are so many elements of our working lives that have sped up, but overall digital transformation still is rather a clunky, slow-moving thing. Of course, because it doesn't just rely on technology integration, it relies on so many other things, right? So skills, abilities, knowledge, but also culture. I think the report mentioned another barrier is people's resistance to digital transformation, which is, and you know, rephrase that another way, resistance to change. That's a normal human characteristic, right?
You mean the Luddites? I mean, I find this digital transformation.
Well, there's that on one end, and then on the other end, it's just people that get nervous about change, right?
I honestly do not understand this digital transformation. How is this any different from the way that businesses and people have evolved, right? So technology is introduced, you learn it, you get onto another one, right? The best example I can have of this is the accounting software space, right? Or even accounting, right? When you started off in the business, maybe a couple of decades ago, you were doing it all book-driven, right? It was all about, you know, books and bookkeeping. And then you'd have the first sort of iteration of the accounting software. It was very clunky. It was very much like, you know, Microsoft Basic. But people started evolving. I mean, the digital transformation thing is, we're always transforming. Like, I'm not trying to poo-poo it, but it feels very Accenture-esque. You know what I mean? Accenture going to, oh, you need digital transformation. Here, pay us $1 million, we'll figure it out. Right. Which really is like, here's some software, here's some training, get to know it. Right. You look at, again, going back to the accounting software, it's like, you know, first iteration was like Microsoft Basic. And then there was a bunch of other stuff like, whatever the previous iteration was, it was all kind of, and then you get the likes of Xero, right, which is basically API driven. You plug in TransferWise, you plug in your bank accounts, you plug in all sorts of work, and you have this amazing looking UI, right? And you know, it's just a matter of just being able to use the software, right? It's making your life easier, and I guess that's the kind of thing. Because like, people get overwhelmed with terms like digital transformation. What the fuck do you mean? Like, it's just basically making your work life easier. Here's some software to run your business easier, right? I log into Xero and I can see the balance sheet and profit loss, and I can see cash flow, and it's just like, wow, I don't need to ring up my accountant or whatever. I got a bunch of books down and flick through this stuff. It's just there.
It's interesting though, Kieran, the way you characterize it. This is really interesting the way you're characterizing it, because I would say you are, I understand what you mean, but you are somewhat oversimplifying it. And also, I'd like to highlight to listeners that you needed to be talked through yesterday how to make the sound in the Zoom call that you were recording work, because you'd accidentally attached your wireless headphones. So, you know.
I don't generally use Zoom. It's like, you know, it's, that's a fair point.
You understand my point.
But that is not something that to be worried about. That's a 2 minute sort of figure out thing. Like,
you know, I know, but I guess the wider point here is that there are some people in operational roles that spend their days dealing with technology platforms, and probably are now dealing with a number of different technology platforms, and that's making their lives a little bit more complex. It's not saying that it's not improving the way that people, systems and processes and the way that people would work before in the past, but it's to say that in some sectors and in some industries and for some people's jobs, it's far more complex than that. Joe, right. Go on. Shush, Kieran.
People are just lazy, right?
Shush. Clearly.
I don't think it's people being lazy. I think it's literally the speed of change and the proliferation, if I can say the word, of platforms that we're being exposed to. And then it's the complexities of organizations. So yes, accounting is one area of a business that is benefiting from technology, but equally, you know, you've got supply chain and logistics, which is having to deal with a whole different set of vendors, and you've got sales, which is dealing with different platforms and different channels. You've got customer service, and all of those things are trying to adopt and embrace a variety of different tech, which is going to need new talent, new capabilities, new technologies. And then on top of that, one of the advantages I was reading about these digital adoption platforms is they can act as hubs to understand how technology is being used and deployed around an organization. So if you're in the business for a new CDP, instead of the marketing department just going, right, I've just bought this new CDP and I've plugged it in, you can now check what impact that's going to have on the rest of your business. Because if other parts of your business are using that, the data coming out of that CDP, then you swap it out for something else, it could impact a much greater or have a much greater impact on your overall business without you even knowing it. So I think, yeah, I mean, I agree, this is all about transformation and change and evolution of working practices, but it's complicated, and there's a lot of moving parts, and it's all happening at once. And I think that is the inherent problem.
And also, come on, this does apply to the ad tech industry, right? Like, we spend our lives talking about the complexity of technology solutions available across advertising and marketing and the ways in which those solutions are deployed. We've all heard stories of ad tech acquisitions when companies that aren't, their core business isn't advertising technology, and they acquire an ad tech solution, try to integrate it into their business. It doesn't really work. It doesn't really go very well. And then, you know, in a couple of years' time, it's sunsetted. if that's even a word.
That's more down to the acquirer not doing the proper due diligence in the company and realizing.
It might not be just that, though, Ciarán. It might also be some of the things that Joe just touched upon, which is someone somewhere in an organization buys something and goes, look, guys, we should use this for this. But people don't necessarily adopt it and apply it in that way. It's, especially in large organizations, it must be incredibly difficult to understand how technology is deployed and used on a daily basis from a helicopter view.
Businesses have created silos which have worked very effectively up until this point. Now everything's becoming interconnected because of digital. And so, you know, one department making a decision could have an impact. And I think having that awareness, that visibility is important these days.
Yeah.
But I do think it is the speed at which we are having to upskill and transform ourselves. That is really the challenge. It's not, you know, historically, I think you'd bring in new technology and you'd be able to instantaneously see the impact because it was one thing that you were dealing with one department, perhaps. Now it's like constant change, constant evolution. We've got new platforms, you know, we've got social media, social commerce, social customer relations. It's like you've got to be all places all at once, and you've got to have the capabilities to provide for that. And that's tough. That is super tough.
That's why you need an agency, so you don't have to think about those problems. That's why the service layer exists, because, you know, it's complex.
Indeed it does, yeah. That's exactly why we're here.
Exactly. And that's perfect setup for now moving on to the last part of the podcast, which is a very brief, Joe, Q&A with you, if you like, about what you're focusing on at the moment at Publicis. And I guess what we'd be particularly interested in, we've been talking a lot this year at ExchangeWire about that very notion, right, the future of the advertising and marketing industry, and what we keep referring to as the three pillars of the industry look like. So the service layer, what we're also referring to as the mad tech middleware, which is effectively the technology layer, and then what that sort of does to the overall media business. And we've been talking a lot about the emergence of commerce media as a sort of new model for transactional model for advertising and marketing. So anyway, I'll let you talk. Tell us what's happening at Publicis Media Precision.
Well, it's all of those things. So we are very much focused on the e-commerce space. What are the solutions and services that we need to be providing to help our clients? And that's, you know, ever evolving. How do advertisers engage with the e-tailer platforms? How do they create direct-to-consumer platforms? You know, what are the innovations around influencer? What are the innovations around live commerce, which is, you know, an up-and-coming area of focus? So, you know, the live sellers, and there's, you know, all sorts of technologies that are emerging in that space, which could transform how brands are presenting themselves in front of their customer base. So that's still a big. Oh, well, that's going to be a big innovation focus for us. A lot of focus still on data. And that, again, a massively expansive topic. But, you know, how do we ensure that we're managing data in the right way, that we're prioritizing consumer privacy whilst sort of delivering relevance for our customers? How do we work with identity in a cookie-less future? So the usual topics there. I think, you know, those are probably the biggest areas that we're focused on. And then clearly kind of the evolution of various platforms. So, you know, the rise of TikTok, and what impact is that going to be having on social? Because clearly there's a very big change of emphasis that's happening there, moving away from the newsfeed into content creation and creativity. And what's the impact of that going to be on the solutions and services that we need to bring to our clients?
And do you think, as well, being in the APAC region and you know, in general, having a lot of clients that will be Asian companies, are you seeing some sort of either emerging trends or faster moving trends, particularly around e-commerce? And, you know, you mentioned live selling. It feels to me like that's something that originated in Asia, really. So do you feel that you're sort of, you know, experiencing some of that well ahead of other markets?
Yeah, look, I think we've got the advantage because it did emerge out of China, really. It's now rapidly sort of expanding across Southeast Asia and other sort of Asian markets. So we definitely got the advantage. There are lots of lessons to be learned. Obviously, things that happen in China tend not to work in exactly the same way outside China, but it doesn't mean that they don't have relevance and they're not going to fly. I mean, TikTok's a great example. So, yes, I think it's early stages around live commerce, but there's definitely advantages to being in this region and being able to pick up the phone to our colleagues in Shanghai.
I can only imagine. And then just briefly, perhaps then on the technology side of things, like you said, you know, everyone is keenly focused on how to prepare for, personalized targeted advertising beyond identifiers and third-party cookies. How are you approaching that from a technology standpoint? So are you just sort of, working your way through available solutions at the moment? Are you doing some testing? Are you experimenting? I guess this is also a two-pronged question. What's your approach from an agency point of view, but also are you being sort of driven by clients' curiosity?
Our approach is to explore what options are available to us and try and understand them. And thankfully, we now have a longer window to do that. And that's really interesting because, we're still able to talk to all of the usual suspects that we need to work with. So we're working, obviously, with the solutions that the walled gardens are providing. We're working with the solutions that the third-party data vendors are now reinventing. And there are new players that are coming onto the scene. So increasingly, we're talking to, the telcos about solutions that they're starting to bring to the market. And I think the question is, what can we try out and how do we make sure that what we're seeing is robust and comparable to the way that we've been operating today? I think, what was the second part of your question? I've forgotten it.
Just, are you being driven by clients on that at all? So are some of your clients sort of curious and inquisitive about what their marketing and advertising, stack will look like going forward?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think there's one client that's not thinking about this. I think it's just interesting to see how it's playing out across organizations, and it comes back to this transformation discussion. So, at the very top, there's definitely a keen agenda to understand and develop solutions that will enable brands to behave differently. But kind of at the grassroots planning level, we're still very much anchored in the legacy behaviors that we've always used. So cheap reach, cheap frequency, get the KPIs, get the benchmarks, and we won't worry about the rest. So I think there's still an adoption curve that we've got to go through, and simply the test and learn approach and amplifying those results, those case studies across the network to help people understand what they're getting into will be important.
Yeah, definitely. So many more questions I could ask. We've run out of time. Hopefully, we will be getting the chance to be having lots of in-person discussions sometime in the not too distant future when we next get to Singapore. Joe, thanks so much. Yeah, totally. Really looking forward to it. Thanks so much for making some time for us. And thank you too to the guest appearances from your small children. That was delightful. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks. Sorry about that. But thanks very much for having me. I've really enjoyed the discussion.
Love the chaos. We love the chaos.
Yeah, this is my life, Kieran, my life.
I know, it's fine. Okay, we'll get them on the next time. We'll answer a couple of questions with TikTok.
And thank you very much, Kieran, for enjoying us.
I really enjoyed all of you. Thank you. It was such an enjoyable moment to be, just a joy.
What I meant to say was for making a sort of, highly unusual guest appearance on your own podcast.
I was wheeled in at the last minute,
You were not wheeled in at the last minute. Joe, this is my life.
I'm on the
managing here. Always saying the wrong thing.
Yeah, I'm going to leave you guys to it. I can't get involved with that.
Hold on, it's a real honour, Joe, to be talking with you today, but, it's great.
It's good to see you, Kieran. Yeah,
we'll
look forward to a pint next time.
Oh, absolutely. And we will be doing ATS. Singapore, get your ticket now.
March 30 and 31. That is the plan. That is the plan at the moment, anyway. And actually, before we go, I'm also going to mention ATS London coming up on November the 3rd and 4th. Get your tickets today. Tickets are selling very swiftly. And we've got an amazing lineup, which you can obviously see at exchangewire.com. And I suppose it's just important to note that we're super excited about this more than any other ATS event, because it's been 2 years since we've hosted an ATS event. So
2 years.
Yeah. So it's going to be epic. Wish you could be here, Joe.
It's in the Velodrome, listeners, in the Velodrome. And I'm cycling in my opening panel in a pair of Lycra on my bike with several world champions. And I'm going to race them before the first panel.
Yeah. Wow, that's almost worth flying back for.
100%. That's worth hotel quarantine, surely.
You'll be able to see all my COVID bits and bobs in person.
Okay. Really drawing a line under this now. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Joe. Thank you very much, Kieran. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.
Bye-bye.